And back in the seat, I'm not sitting in a saddle. We lead into ArtCast, show where a couple of visual storytellers get together and take a walk around a slippery, elusive, sometimes dangerous topic. And I made it sound like it's, you know, full of hazard, full of peril. Well, the way you deal with peril is you come up with, you know, a system. You analyze the situation and you conquer the situation. And Rob, I'm going to see if you've got it again. You've been on a roll with the last several episodes with the analogy for our system of taking on these topics. By the way, my name is Jerzy Drozd, and I'll let Rob and our guest introduce themselves.
Hey, I'm Rob Stenzinger, and this is our special guest to my left.
Hi, I'm Kate Shield Stenzinger.
Awesome. Welcome, Kate. And to pick up where you left off, Jerzy, so we try to deal with those dangerous, challenging topics, and all of us creative folks and people who try to make stuff deal with. And we find the when we split apart our own let's call it a gut atom, and then all sorts of ooky energy splooches out of that gut atom. And not only does it smell, not only do we have to avoid the mess, but we have to find a way to get across the mess and then probably get some cleaning supplies on the other side. So in the beginning, we deal with it's all about this, the assessing the situation. We lay the groundwork in the beginning as we observe this mess. And then as we cross to the other side and we know what we're dealing with, we pick up our cleaning tools and we share cleaning healthy tips with each other to clean up the mess. And we make sure they have extra fresh scent embedded inside, which makes it smell good.
I find fabric softener sheets. Put them in a drawer with fabric softener sheets.
Very good. Very good helpy tip.
Yeah, there'll be more in the second half. More coming in the second half of the show. So, okay, well, Kate Shield Stenzinger, so glad to have you back.
Thank you.
Your second time on the show, my first time doing the show with you. Kate, tell us about your background, and that'll lead into what the topic is and the curveball for this episode.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'm very pleased to be here again, so thank you, Rob and Jerzy, for inviting me back again. That's awesome. My background, my formal educational training, if you will, is in child psychology and child development and mental health and children's mental health specifically, and I also trained as a play therapist and worked as a play therapist for a while. The disclaimer I always like to give is I'm not currently practicing. So I do different work now, but it's still a passion of mine and an area of mine that I get really interested and excited about, from child development and, again, just kind of how we approach play.
Now, you say that you put out a disclaimer that you're not a practicing play therapist right now, but that said, I was a blackjack dealer many years ago. And whenever people find that out, the first question they ask is, how do you win? So, like, there's an assumption that, you know, because I did it once, that I'm, you know, an expert on the topic. So I don't know if that disclaimer is necessary, but I guess in certain academic circles, you need to say that, don't you?
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, we have a 3.5-year-old, and so I do fall back into it, and I don't know if you've ever gone to a casino and tried to win big, because you were a blackjack dealer once, but there are days where I just go, I wish I didn't know what this meant, what you're saying or what you're doing.
In my situation, it's probably a little bit different, because I can't even stand, like, the sound of a slot machine actually makes me break out in hives. I mean, it really, really upsets me now. It's almost like a Clockwork Orange kind of thing. I'm sure that a laughing child does not do that to you, Kate.
No, I'm the mom at the playground who's playing with all the kids, because I'm interested in kind of how they're viewing their world.
And that's another thing I should point out. I mean, like, this is totally like an aside, but I mean, I wonder how much of this has to do with your background as a play therapist. But I've seen how you interact with your daughter, and I've seen how other parents interact with their kids. And I just went, you know, back to school sales are starting. And so I had to go to get crayons at Target. And I saw some parents very stressed out trying to get their kids school supplies and, you know, like being snappy and barking at their kids like, no, get over here. I've never heard you use language like that with your child. I spent a whole day with you guys when you're out here for Kids Read Comics. And it was very much like you're talking to her like an adult, but just using language that she understood.
Yeah. Well, that's the goal, you know, of course. Not always 100%. And, you know, but I think what is important for us is how you respond in those times that aren't 100%. So if I have snapped at her, you know, a few weeks back, I can't remember what it was, but her and I were just at each other. And finally, I just kind of sat down on the floor and I said, you and mommy are both really crabby. And we kind of talked about it, and I think we determined we'd had too much sugar and not enough sleep, both of us. And, of course, that does get thrown back in my face then now, you know, where mommy, if you had too much sugar and not enough sleep, if things aren't going her way. But, again, it's kind of what do you do with that information? How do you respond to those situations?
Oh, man, your kid is going to rule the world. I mean, because just that simple act right there is saying, all right, let's stop and assess the situation.
Right.
Look at what's happening. Let's be in the moment, but also look at the moment at the same time and see what's going on. Rather than, look, I'm the grown-up, you're the kid, go to your room. Just
right.
get out of here. I have the power, you don't. And until you're stronger than me, this is the way it's going to be, right?
And I'll add to that, for us, it's kind of that moment where we have to stop and say, and this kind of leads to where we're going tonight, this isn't fun anymore. My interactions, I'm not having fun, you're not having fun, this isn't fun anymore. Stop, let's figure out why we're not having fun.
Wow, what a pro. Let's do that as a segue.
No kidding, there's no better segue.
There is no better segue. I'm done. It's signed out. So yeah, Rob, I want to pitch it both of you guys. Based on this episode's topic, it occurred to me, and especially because I just finished a 6-week course at the Ann Arbor District Library, where the entire thing was done as, it was 6 sessions, but in each session were like between 3 and 4 games that amounted to a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking a lot about this, like designing games. Not, I don't have a lot of experience in this, and I'm intuiting a lot of it. And one of the things that I'm watching as I'm watching people participate in these games is noticing when it stops being fun for them so that I can adjust and, you know, change direction, loose knees in the ship and all that. So my question for you guys is, when is a game no longer fun? How do you detect it? Like, how do you know when to sit down on the floor with Kaya and say, hey, we're crabby?
Yeah. Well, let's see. When this is the two rare exceptions in the history of our podcast when we actually discuss the curveball ahead of time, right? So this is the known curveball thing. So I was thinking of it thinking of traditional games and when they, you know, video games basically, and so when aren't they fun? But then you described an interesting situation, Jersey, that I've been so curious to hear about how your class turned out, where you walked us through some examples of how you were presenting some interesting challenges that you were exploring aspects of storytelling, not dealing with saying, okay, guess what? We're going to go into the nitty-gritty basics of doing comics. Here's a page. Here's panels. Here's word balloons. Here's, you know, sound effects, all that. You went into really these little these sort of self-contained exercises, right? That I'm so curious. Like, it sounds like some of them. Like, I'll answer your question, but I've been dying to know. You noticed when people weren't having fun, right? So you're presenting essentially a thing to them, like a game is essentially what? It's a I love the Jane McGonigal definition, where I think it's she proposes a game is a series of voluntary obstacles with an increasing difficulty and a goal and a feedback loop. Right? Mm-hmm. And I would bet you're lessons have a ton in common with that. And I'm anyway, so like along those lines, like you, this isn't like standalone thing. When did you notice when people weren't having fun? And like what? How did that feel?
When they weren't stressed out anymore, that's how I noticed. Like when they were tense. I think another thing McGonagall talks about is the epic win face, right?
Yeah.
She did that in one of her TED Talks where it shows this kid making this face. And for those who aren't watching the video, I'm just sucking in my cheeks going like, you know, and like inhaling really sharply through my mouth. And when some of the games started, there was a lot of that going on. There were people who were laughing but frantic to get the thing done in the time I was giving them.
Mm-hmm.
When they weren't stressed out is when I think it wasn't fun for them anymore. And I think mm-hmm. that there were a few games where I was too explicit in the outset as to what they were going to accomplish. And okay. the time I gave them too much time. So they it seemed like a foregone conclusion. When I was more mysterious about what it was they were actually doing with this stuff, and I gave them tighter time limits, they had a lot more fun doing it. So like, for instance, one of the things that I had them do was write down the names of 10 different places that you either been or think about or have thought about visiting. Places that you have like an inclination to visit someday, or you had a good time there, or you had a bad time. It just has like a vivid memory kind of thing. And then had them write the things down. And I didn't set the timer. I let them fill the time as they needed. And then I said, well, now you're going to take these crayons and you're going to draw a color next to each of those cities. You're going to give each city a color.
Mm-hmm.
And then I explained before they were finished that we're going to take this and we're going to do an exercise coming up about world building where we're going to explore how different locations feel through color. And because I tipped that card, it felt like, well, now I know what's going to happen. And I think I lost a few of the students when it came to that, or the players.
Okay. So in other words, they were a little bit into it for the surprise or the dramatic reveal of like, this is where you were landing. And whatnot.
The character design one that I described in a past episode where they were doing what seemed to be very unrelated tasks. And I was giving them way less time than what you would need. And the whole idea was to demonstrate to them that you can come up with this stuff on the fly. You don't have to sit around and I'm trying to, and this is one of the things we're going to talk about today, trying to dispel this idea of if it's not work, it's not good, right? So I'm trying to dispel that. That was what the time limit was about. But what I didn't realize until I did it was that the time limit also makes it exciting. Beat the clock, right? Yeah. And so when I gave them more time than they needed and they didn't have, or so going back to the character design class, when they did these unrelated things and there was all this frantic pacing, we got to get this done. And then when they finally stop and everybody's like, you know, wiping their brows and like, whew, I can't believe I made it. I go, now look down at your paper. You now have a cast of characters. There was the epic win faces all around the room. They're like, I can't believe I just did that.
Wow. Yep.
But I wasn't explicit about that. They had no idea what they were doing. They were just trusting that I was leading them somewhere, but they didn't know until they got to the big boss level and then got to see Mother Brain, right?
And okay, yeah, that is pretty awesome. That's a combination of you have this greater experience in your pocket where all of a sudden these other micro experiences add up to like, da-da, there's this. That's a super cool architecture to that whole class and that series. But what I was really curious, it's so funny. And so you noticed when people were becoming less tense, and I suppose that probably was, I have different motivations when I go to play a game. Like sometimes I do want to relax, and I guess the engagement is something that is like I feel comforted by my skill that's getting tested. But like for instance, I have one of my comfort food games is Golden Axe on the Sega Genesis, and so this is not a situation, like, even though, like, I can solve that game, I know when I sit down to play, I will solve that game if I choose to, unless I'm having a really rough day, and then I'm not feeling it. I'm getting, you know, my reflexes are off or what have you. But there's still variance in what happens. Like, I may solve it faster, or I may lose more lives or whatever. So I still am excited by that game, even though It's kind of a relaxing experience for me. But sometimes, like the huge example for me of when a game doesn't get fun is when it takes that manic feeling of I'm adapting and I'm learning and I'm reacting to all this stimulating stuff, and all of a sudden I'm at my capacity and I can't adapt anymore. And then the game says, no, here's more, here's more, here's more. And I remember vividly playing Halo 1 as the difficulty ramp got to, I'm trying to think, it was somewhere seeing one of the, it's like the first time you saw like one of the crashed alien ships that had the flood in it, I think. Right. And I remember it was coming up a hill, and I was using strategies that I had been successful with before, but it was getting a little bit harder and a little bit harder, where it's like as I was surmounting this hill, all of a sudden it was like there was nowhere to hide, there was nowhere to take cover, and the aliens were just coming, and I ran out of grenades, and like it felt like work. It felt like maybe I could do this, maybe I could, but I don't care anymore. Like I am so tense that this is not the feeling I want to be experiencing right now, you know? And that's when I was like, this isn't fun anymore. This feels like, I'm overwhelmed. So I'm not enjoying myself anymore. So that's a big one. And I do like it when, I noticed this in a similar situation playing Left 4 Dead 2 recently. I think it got patched and like the difficulty level went up, but it had been a few months since I played it. Maybe I got worse at it, granted, perhaps. But even after warming up for a bit, like there was some really crazy situations that, trying to get through this, the shopping mall and it was the whole level where you try to fill up the car with gas and race out of the shopping mall. Anyway, Left 4 Dead, if you're not familiar, which I would assume, yeah. Who knows if anyone in the audience is familiar. So the gist of it is it's a cooperative game that, and I'll stop off this tangent in a little bit, but it's kind of part of the point of this game is a little bit related to the premise of the question, is you're meant to cooperate with four human players. And you can fill in with a computer if you want. And you fight against these overwhelming odds of zombies to get through essentially what's kind of like a movie-length scenario, right? Broken up into chapters. And one of the big things in the game as far as why it's a lot of fun to play is that it has this quote-unquote AI director that's estimating how tense people are. Kind of like Jersey when you're kids in your class.
Okay.
But that's not with zombies. So this AI director is paying attention to how well the characters are doing with various stats or whatnot. And perhaps, you know, coming up with some heuristic or, you know, of like, well, I think this player may be stressed out. I'm going to back off. I'm not going to, you know, put them in this much jeopardy. But I want to not back off for too long because I want to keep them engaged, right? So it's just managing this ebb and flow of that. And I would say that game was tuned to perfection before. And like now playing it, it felt like it got tuned a little too far to the, I'm going to keep your attention at this ultimate high manic intensity. Without the ebb and flow, that's when I tune out and I say it's not fun anymore.
Good observation. Ebb and flow. I'm writing that down just for my own purposes.
You know, I think there's something else in there that's interesting too, just keying off the video game theme. When I think about when I play, so Rob has much more experience than I do. So there are certain games that we pick up and we try to play together, and I very quickly say, this is not fun. this is not fun for me. Yeah. I'm inherently not a competitive person, so this is not fun. Because I don't know, or it's too difficult, and he's able to kind of forge on ahead. And even if it's a cooperative game, you know, so it's not that I'm losing, it's just that I'm really struggling. I don't know how to do it, and he seemingly kind of has everything. Not as fun. But there have been a couple of games through the years, and as you were talking that through, it reminds me of Mario Kart. Mm. So Mario Kart, we would hook, you know, together and have several people playing. And I'm not a video gamer. I'm horrible at this. But I loved playing that game. You know why? I'm in last place. I'm getting all the really good power-ups. So that game is also paying attention to, you know what? This chick's been in eighth or ninth place the whole time. It's going to give me Bullet Bob, and I'm going to, you know, get up and be second or third.
Does it really do that?
Yeah.
It gives you better power-ups if you perform poorly in the...
Absolutely, yeah. You'll get the bullet, or you'll get power-ups that negatively affect all the other racers, but they don't affect you if you're in those backward, you know, far back positions. Or you'll get the blue shell, which is that hits the person in the lead and punishes them above anyone else.
So my point being that even though it's hard for me and maybe my tension or my interest is waning, those games, and I also think of, what was the Star Wars
Battlefront?
Battlefront mm-hmm. also had similar ways where I could really be successful in that game, and it was a co-op game, and I could be very successful in it. Kept me very engaged, and I love playing those games. So it's just kind of interesting, is what are they doing differently than, you know, playing Left 4 Dead, or what was the other one we always tried to play that I would get, where you build the levels with the little sack guy?
I can't believe I'm blanking on it either. But it's, PlayStation 3 game, Little Sack Boy. Little Big Planet.
There you go. I got frustrated with that game. Didn't have the physics down. Yep. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't. This could easily hijack the whole episode because this is fast. And I just want to like pick your guys' brain because I'm getting like a lot of great insights for my classes, like power ups for poor performance.
Yeah.
Who would have thought? Right.
Those alternate. Yeah, exactly. You get to find another way to feel successful and just.
Well, keep you in the game.
Yeah.
This is a topic that's been getting passed around quite a bit on the internet over the last couple of days, at least in the feeds that I follow, almost to the point where it's insufferable. Somebody wrote an article about why do all the Pixar films and Disney films encourage kids with these unrealistic ideas of dreaming big and you're special? Why don't we teach them more? And like some of the discussion has been surrounding this idea of we shouldn't teach kids to dream so big because what if the kid says, I want to be a dragon when I grow up? So other people are saying that, no, we should teach them to fail more often. Now there, I kind of go, that's interesting because failure leads to learning, which leads to success. So like, and it is something that often in traditional classrooms is a punitive kind of thing. Whereas something that I've been dabbling with, and I think the problem is I don't trust my students enough. I think I need to trust them more. Is I need to get more excited when they do a really lousy job on something, you know. And I've been trying to say things like, "Well, I want you to draw sloppy. You're supposed to draw sloppy because that's what this is about. Or it's about getting ideas on paper. This isn't about drawing something wonderful that mom's going to put on the fridge." But if I could spin that around and turn it into you get a, because I think I was telling you before, Rob, I was doing like just silly little things like buttons. And like I brought some free comics, like anytime anybody contributes to the class in a positive way, positive meaning like it helps somebody or it's insightful or it's an interesting hack of the game, you get a button. And even the adults were on board with this. So where's my button? Where's my button? But if I could write in a thing like that for rewarding failure, like you have the most epically bad hands I've ever seen on a character, you know? And you know what that means? That means that your hands are going to get great someday because there's nowhere to go but up. I don't know, but to not explain I think that where I could go wrong is if I explain the concept too directly to say like, well, failure leads to success because that's an abstract concept that a 10-year-old doesn't give a darn about, right? But if I could turn failure into a rewarding experience, then they won't fear failure so much, which means they will learn more in the long run. That's the hope.
One way to think about it is maybe perhaps it's a mapping territory kind of thing. So you discover the edge of a situation, right? Yeah. So these are the worst hands perhaps possible, right? Mm-hmm. And that's pretty awesome. Maybe that's like a signature thing. Or now what else are the worst? So yeah, I mean, you're inherently saying that in this space, there's a wide set of possibilities and then... you've come away with one of the amazing discoveries.
And then that encourages them to try new things. It encourages mm-hmm. them to take risks and take chances because, well, I'm either going to succeed or I'm going to fail, but I get rewarded either way. There's a benefit in either.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Man. God, that was good, guys. We went like 20 minutes on that. But we got to get the topic because there's somebody listening right now who's saying like, what? Why are you talking about teaching? You're supposed to be talking about art. This ties into the main topic of the day, and I'm going to fire off the music to indicate that we are about to head 10,000 feet up. And I chose cheerful, uplifting music, playful music, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys get to watch that video?
Yes.
Yes.
So what did you think? Great.
What did you think, Kate?
I thought it was really good. I thought she had some very interesting concepts. And I really, you know, she's a wonderful presenter and she's just got a lot of kind of great energy behind her. So that always makes it fun too.
Yeah.
And watching it was joyful. Watching it felt like play, which I thought was kind of an interesting experience when I kind of stopped and reflected back on just the experience of watching it. It was like, it was very playful.
We're talking about a video, a talk by Linda Barry, a cartoonist and artist. We'll link to it in the show notes. But I posted about it on Google Plus, a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same talk she did when she visited Ann Arbor recently. Amazing cartoonist and really just captivating public speaker. And one of the topics that she really explores a lot in the talk is, what is the nature of image? And it was a really thought-provoking discussion that I found Anne and I were debating for hours afterward. Like, well, what did she mean when she said image, you know? And, like, I found myself using analogy a lot to try to explain what I thought she meant, but I couldn't pin it down either. But one of the big ideas, and I think it pervades all of her talk, but it wasn't, like, an explicit, like, no, I'm going to talk about play. But she talks a lot about being playful. And something I've quoted her on repeatedly in other shows and other places is the thunderbolt moment for me was when she said, when you see kids playing, you don't see the little girl with the two fashion dolls saying, all right, Barbie and Ken, this will be a three-act play, and you know you're going to enter at this time and you're going to leave at this time. They just kind of roll with it and just pretend, and it's this joyous, playful experience without any kind of set agenda. It's open to discovery and everything. And I'm framing this up before we dive into the topic. I did an old episode of the Thunder Punch Daily Show years ago where I was trying to address this idea of how I think of writing. And I said, if you watch kids in the playground, they're just pretending. They're just saying, I'm the chameleon and I'm a super spy and I can change color to match any environment. And I'm Digar and I have shovels for hands and I put up a deflector shield. They're just working it out together collaboratively. And there's nobody says like, no, that's a bad idea. They'll argue over the rules. Like, no, you can't put up a deflector shield after I've used the death ray. But they won't, right? They argue over the rules of engagement of the game, but I never hear little kids saying, like, that's a stupid idea and you're bad for thinking it.
That's really derivative.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like Stanley did that 20 years ago, please. Yeah, thank goodness kids don't have to deal with that at least. I mean, they got to deal with bullies, but they don't got to deal with snooty bullies. But anyway, so like I was trying to describe this idea of like, you know, it's like writing is just playing pretend. And that's kind of borderline, what am I trying to say? Glib. I don't want anybody to come off the thing that I'm saying, oh, it's just as simple as pretending. But I think that there's a spirit there that is kind of, once you get in touch with it, you can intuit it. And it's sort of like when I'm trying to describe what Linda Barry means by image, I can sort of express it through analogy, but I can't really pin it down. So with that, I want to talk about the spirit of play. And thank goodness we got a play therapist here to help us understand why being playful in our work, or what benefits there are to being playful in our work.
So let's see. I'm not the play therapist, right? But one of the things that struck me from your example. Actually, I remember listening to that that Thunder Punch Daily a couple years back, and yeah, there's a lot of really strong themes across that talk and Linda Berry's talk. To me, it seems like there's different stages to this where you have an intent to where you're like, I've got some time to play and playing in a creative way, inherently you're going to be generating something, right? Like maybe you're acting out a scene with characters. Maybe they're in your head. Maybe they're your hands. Maybe they are, a water bottle and a keychain. Whatever it is, you could be relating to these things and playing through it. But like a lot of times when we go at work, even though we may need a phase like that, we end up tackling it in a very aggressively and staunchly rational way that tends to look at it as like a very industrial endeavor. It's not a task. It's a series of tasks. And in fact, it's this kind of, step-by-step pipeline. I make my outline and then I turn the outline into dialogue in this way or whatever. Where maybe I could have just found the same dialogue and had it so much more lively if I would have started out by just talking to my hand.
Yeah.
So one of the things, and I've got a couple things about play that I can share as we go through this, but one of the things that comes to mind is that I want to ask both of you. So, Jersey, when you play, why do you play?
Why do I play? I play to exist in a place as it could and should be. I think. I play to... let me make sure I understand the question properly. It's like when I'm being playful in my work or like when I'm playing games?
Either. Why do you play?
It's to transport myself to someplace else. I mean, because the games that I enjoy the most are the ones where, and I've talked about this repeatedly, the Metroid series is my absolute number one favorite game of all time because I'm transported to a place where I am completely isolated and I am searching. Those are my two favorite aspects of the game, is that you are alone in a weird environment and you are looking for things. Whereas games like when you described Left 4 Dead or Halo, I tried playing Halo, and it just it was too much action. Metroid has comparatively less action, and there's more exploration and puzzle solving and things. Resident Evil 2, I really enjoyed because of all the puzzle solving, and the creepy dread thing was like a bonus. It was fun to kind of scare myself a little bit, but it's to transport myself. And it's the same thing when I'm doing playful drawing. It's to, exist someplace else for a little while. Escapism.
Why do you play?
Let's see. Jersey mentioned escapism. I think it's typically, escapism. And there's certain, I want to, let's see. It's funny because it's not just the topic of the fantasy, because I know that there's games like that will seem appealing on the surface, but maybe it'll just sit on the shelf, right? Like and because it's not as rewarding. So I think I want to both escape and be rewarded, and I have a couple of fantasy quirks that I really enjoy. Like, if there's a game that lets me jump vehicles over stuff, it's probably Dukes of Hazzard related.
Right.
It's probably, but favorite thing.
But then again, like a game I got kind of hooked on for a while there was that Simpsons Tapped Out game, which is just like Farmville, building Springfield. Part of it was that fantasy quirk thing where it's like, I like it when Homer says woohoo after I do a thing.
Sure.
But also, it's about making my neat little world, too, right? This isn't like I'm not existing there. Well, I guess I kind of am, but it's not the same kind of immersive experience like a Metroid. This is more like playing with Legos, but they're moving around and they're talking to me.
Yeah. Different kind of product for your investment.
Right. Yep. So what I was kind of just kind of listening for and listening into from when you guys were talking is neither of you play to produce something. Neither of you play thinking about the outcome. Neither of you play to complete the game, to finish it. Like, I didn't hear either of you say, yeah, when I sit down and I'm going to play a board game, you know, I'm going to play an epic game of Monopoly, and my favorite thing about playing an epic game of Monopoly is that it takes us 3 days and we finish it. And that moment of finishing is just, neither of you said that. And it's about the experience. And this is something, you know, pulling it back to art. When I am with my child or other children and we're doing art, I have to constantly remind myself, and I think I said this on the last podcast, that it's not about the end product for them. It's about the experience. And that's what play is for children. It's about the experience. In Jersey, your example of the kids on the playground, you know, I'm going to be, you know, this guy and I'm going to do this. They don't then go, wait, let me go write that down because I want to remember that for tomorrow.
Yeah. I'm working to novelize this. Review that part. Yeah.
You know,
sure of your motivation.
Now they may reenact that character over and over again. And typically that's because they did develop some attachment to it. There was some exploration in there that they really liked. So again, back to that kind of adrenaline high that we talked about in other games of, I really liked the fact that when I played that dude, I could fly. I'm going to be him again today. And I'm going to build on that story.
Yeah.
It's about that experience.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I was recently completely hooked on the Skylanders game. Recently, about a year ago, to the point where I spent a lot more money on that game than I should have. I spent money I didn't have on those darn figures. And, you know, it's like, but when Ann and I got to about the 3/4 mark of the game and we're coming up to where we realized, oh, we're almost done, it suddenly ceased being interesting to us because we knew it was coming to a close. And because it was one of those linear kind of like beat these 12 obstacles so you get to the big bad guy at the end and then you win rather than you can just explore and play, the game lost a lot of its charm. Still fun to play, but every time we plug it in, it's like we go back and play older levels because we would rather be in the world with these fun creatures than get to that finish line.
That's interesting because I think, doesn't Linda Berry talk about that with reading books?
Oh, yeah, that's right. She talks about when you start getting to like the 3/4 mark or like the last 100 pages, you start reading slower and slower because
you want
to drink in that experience.
Yeah, world to stay.
Yeah. So, you know, there's going to be somebody out there who's saying like, yeah, but work is work. And if it's not, you know, like there's this glamorous idea around the idea of the artist who says, and gosh, we just talked about this recently, Rob, this idea of like, I put in 14 hours a day. Nobody works harder than me. This piece of art that I made took 4 weeks to make this thing. It's so hard. And people ask you, I'm guilty of this. When Dean Tripp was on the Comics are Great show and he showed that, we talked about his giant piece, the You'll Be Safe Here piece. Did you guys see this? It's Batman with his arm around a little boy and they're walking into the TARDIS and there's like 100 superhero and science fiction hero characters in the room. And like the single sentences, you'll be safe here. And it's a very impressive piece. Even one of my first questions I asked him was, how long did that take? Oh, what a stupid question. It doesn't matter.
I don't know if we can help it, man. Like, so what's tangible to us when we're going to engage in some kind of endeavor and we are thinking of it in this mindset of like, I need to budget for a task or what have you, or, you know, I'm about to set off to construct a thing. How much is it going to cost me? We know about clocks, calendars, and our wallet, right? How much is it going to cost me in any of those three, you know, clocks as far as, you know, if it's less than you know what's useful for to measure with the calendar, but like that stuff gets thrown around all the time when you're planning a project. Even if you don't know the thing well enough to come up with that answer, like I bet if you've done a certain style of comic, in a certain, you know, assuming art style, assuming the volume of content, assuming a lot of different, you know, variables are locked in, you probably can do some really pretty tight estimation, right?
Sure.
But like if there were, let's see, I don't know, some totally unfamiliar medium, new piece of software, so like throw in a bunch of variables, all of a sudden certainty starts to go down, right? Anyway, I think we'd love to find this, that certainty that we, you know, we can measure that stuff, even when it's not that informative.
What I should have asked, though, in retrospect, what I should have asked was, how fun was that to do?
Mm. Oh, man. Good.
That would have been a far superior question.
How fun. Wow. Yeah. I think all of us have this, but maybe it's a cultural thing that we've all soaked in a bit. I don't think it's always celebrated as far as the hours, right? So I put in so many hours, and it sounds so, you know, okay. But I mean, did it? I get all because I really analyze myself and try to pay attention to, you know, when I am actually producing. Because I have spent many a long hour at a desk doing a, you know, variety of jobs and whatnot, and I started to notice like I'm not being that productive, and so like okay, I was doing this 16 hours today, but like what? Not really. Not if I break it down and I'm honest more, you know, and more present with it. So anyway. But I just there's something attractive to it. Oh, and you want here's another hunch why, I don't know, this may not be accurate, but it's a hunch. Because we get paid along those lines, right? So why do we, it sounds like, oh, you could have, you know, you've cashed those 16 hours somehow. That's you traded those in
time
for valuable cash and prizes. What's that? Yeah.
No, you're right.
I don't know.
Is there anything to kind of the idea that we have a pride almost around that? I think, Jersey, you had given examples earlier of, you know, this took me 4 weeks. And is there some pride in there? Even, you know, you guys spoke a bit about games before. The games will tell you exactly how many hours and minutes you have spent on them. You know, and I don't know if that's a generational thing or if that's kind of always been around, but you hear people talk about, yeah, I, you know, I finished Halo in X number of hours.
Yeah. Or, mm-hmm. Yeah. Like even when we were kids, there was like, oh, he can beat Mario 1 in 3 hours without warping. Right. And like that's
right.
Like, that's like a real big, you know, they see the article in Nintendo Power Magazine about that kid. That is weird.
Trying to frame this up. I mean, have we? What are some of the takeaways from this so far in looking at? I mean, so there's kind of a gravity well away from fun, and so we get pulled away from it, and we don't value the fun as much because we're not as good as measuring it.
Well, I'd like to hear Kate's input on this because my suspicion is that our obsession with productivity and time ratios. Distract us from the fun exploration of the thing. Now, I'm not saying that every job necessarily needs to be a game and we need to gamify everything in the entire world, though some people may argue that. It's just that I even found myself, so like I've been posting these progress sketches of this ambitious He-Man piece that I started out doing, again, in the spirit of play. Friday rolls around. I finished my work for my freelance work for the day a little bit early. I had like an hour before I had to go pick up my wife from work. I'm like, I'm going to draw something for fun. And I have two observations on this. One is, when I first started it, I started it thinking about who was going to see it and it was not fun. And, I was thinking about, well, what would so-and-so say about this? What would so-and-so say about that? oh, so-and-so once told me that He-Man should look this way, so I'll try that. And I was like, oh, it doesn't look very good. It doesn't look right. I can't put my finger on it, but there's something wrong here. I was like, well, wait a second. I caught myself. I sat down on the floor and I said, I'm cranky. I'm thinking about my audience instead of just enjoying the work. Do this for yourself and don't think about anybody else in the world. Just think about how much you like He-Man. So I start drawing. And then next thing I know, an hour later, I got like half of a page done and it looks pretty darn good, if I do say so myself. So this comes to my second observation, is that suddenly it turned into work, because the next thing I noticed was, as I was crank, I was like, it was the kind of thing where I woke up Saturday morning and it was like the first thing I wanted to do. You know, how often does that happen where you're like, I gotta get to work. I just can't wait. Like, making comics is awesome and I love making comics, but there are mornings where I get up where I'm like, I'm hitting the snooze. I'm tired. But this is like, oh, I'm at seven. Maybe I should just get up and go downstairs and start working on that thing again. And suddenly I noticed I was logging a lot of hours in this thing over the weekend. And the first thought I had was like, I shouldn't be doing this. You know, there's other things I should be doing. How many hours have I started putting in? I better start tracking this. And suddenly I watched the fun meter. No. Right. So I want to hear Kate weigh in on this about like how our focus on going back to this idea of the experience when you're doing play therapy or when you're working with Kaya. I mean, are you going like, come on, Kaya, chop, chop. You know, swing three more times, and then you've done your full swing for the day.
Yeah, sometimes I am, but that's not my good. That's not the good side. I think one of the distinctions that I would encourage you guys and your audience to think about is the difference between play and fun. No matter what work you do, you can have fun at it, right? You can have fun, and I think play has a different purpose. And even in your describing, Jersey, you sat down to do your drawing and you were like, I was going to do it for play. In the first one you did, it may have started out fun and it didn't become that way. When you then, the way you described taking kind of the second swing at it, that was play. You were doing it for you, and its purpose for you was just to do some expression. And that's more what play is about. So play is really a way, so play therapy, and when I did play therapy, it was with very young children. So I did play therapy with 3, 4, and 5-year-olds, like really little kids. And the whole purpose there is for them to allow to really process their emotions, to kind of get out what's going on, good, bad, otherwise. They don't have the verbal skills. They don't have, you know, even the cognitive necessarily, but it's going to come out in their play. And what they're experiencing in their life is going to come out in their play. And just as a little side note, as a play therapist, you're not analyzing that. You're experiencing that with them, and you're helping them to develop, you know, if it's something they need to just get out, if it's something they need to learn to cope with. It isn't about analyzing the kid. It's about allowing them to experience their emotions. Anyway, that's a total side note. When we're thinking about you're in your work and you want to be playful in your work, from an artist's perspective, that's about letting the emotions out. Maybe you draw the darkest comic ever and it's all about self-doubt. That could be very playful for you. Maybe you draw all the My Little Ponies you can possibly think of. Again, it's a way for you to just kind of express, you know, joy and different feelings that you have. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of the distinction, because I think we can all work fun into our work and our lives, but to truly be intentionally playful, it has to stop being about the final product. And I think that's what gets really tricky for art, is it can't be about the final product. It's got to be about, I'm expressing this for myself.
Would you recommend then, Kate, that artists keep more, I mean, I know a lot of artists do, but I personally feel whenever I commit something to paper or to my tablet, if it's good enough, it gets shared, because you got to share stuff. You got to keep your stream active to keep people interested in you, because if you don't have your clout score up, who knows what will happen. So when I'm just doodling on my tablet, maybe 15% of the stuff that I doodle will stay hidden. And mostly because I'll be like, well, that just looks bad. I haven't worked out the idea enough. But like, I'll do these playful things that actually turn into things, and then my first instinct is share. Would you recommend that maybe perhaps somebody with my affliction would be better served if I did try to do more things that were not meant for other people to see?
No.
Oh, okay.
What I'm saying is, when you're doing the doodling, if your mindset is, I got to get something up on Google Plus today,
yeah,
then you're not playing.
Okay.
Your mindset is, I just totally need to express a drawing about the person in front of me. I know an artist who was at a convention and had a horrible experience with a convention goer eating a sandwich, and they needed to express that and had a very fun afternoon drawing that experience out while they sat at this conference. I don't know if anybody wants to elaborate.
I'm holding my breath for some reason. Yeah, well, okay, fine. I was tabling at a conference, and I'm not going to name any names. I will not name the conference, but a convention. And let's see. There was a gentleman showed, whatever. I'll give the gist of the story. A guy shows up and disrespects that these tables are for the artists, right? Sits down, throws down a buffet amount of sandwiches, maybe 10 sandwiches. I might be slightly exaggerating.
Okay.
And also rolls up with a rather large posse of people who were looking to enjoy these sandwiches with him, also not really interested in respecting the artist's space. And they pretty much...
They had lunch over your table?
Walked by table.
They sat in front of his table.
Kind of like made a portion of where the artists were meant to be hanging out into a big old sandwich fest picnic thing.
Oh, God. And, this is at Kids Read Comics, wasn't it?
It was totally not at Kids Read Comics. Anyway, it was, and so because of that mere act, it probably was one of those things like a Ren and Stimpy moment where I was hyper focusing on every little detail, and I was mad. I was like, how do I? And all of a sudden, I'm like, dude, put it into art. So I got out my sketch pad. And I was like, what's going to come out? I don't know. I'm so mad. I'm just going to draw. Let's see what happens. And a drawing came out. And I'm pleased with that drawing. It was not a nice drawing. But I'm pleased with it. And it made me feel immensely joyful.
Would you call that?
I was able to, basically, I was laughing so much inside as I was drawing this, because I started doing absurd things too. It wasn't just like, oh, now these people represent demons of hate that came out of this this terrible orifice of awfulness that whatever.
Orifice of awfulness. I'm totally grabbing that.
Okay, and they, I was, but anyway, but I did channel my frustration and annoyance into a drawing that was both spoofing and silly and whatever. And I shared my amount of pleasure. I shared the story with my wife. Maybe I even shared the drawing, which I will not share with anyone else.
But now, in that experience, did that feel like work or play?
It felt like play. Definitely.
And again, the intent is not to share. Again, if you are doodling, you know, singing a song in the car in the shower, and something that you really love comes out, absolutely share it. Okay. You know, it's more about that intent. That intent was, I was doing this for me. I was doing this because I just needed time to relax, time to express, time to play. And I think, you know, you guys have both shared stories on previous podcasts of really interesting things coming out, you know, in those times. Great storylines, great character development. I think, Jersey, even the class example you gave of your students going through this fun exercise and not knowing they were doing character development, That was playful. It was a game. That was play.
Right.
What do you do though? Like, what would you consider a helpful mindset or strategy when the threshold gets crossed? Because what if?
Are we getting into On the Ground?
Oh, I yep.
Let me play this.
I think we may.
Speaking of play, let's play the stinger. Which one are we gonna do? Oh, we're gonna get serious. Stupid helmet tip time. Although they won't be stupid. On the ground. Time to talk about putting some practical application to these abstract ideas. Do we need to close off the 10,000 feet up with that takeaway? I think Kate, you summed it up beautifully. Is like play is self-expression, and it's the intent. It's the who did I intend this for? Me. What happens to it afterwards is inconsequential because the intent of the audience of you is what defines it as play. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. I do have one thing I do want to read that kind of I think will also help kind of bridge from one to the other. As I was pulling up some of my play therapy books, and this just kind of got me excited earlier, and it's talking about, you know, why children play. And I would equate this also to, you know, why artists play, why any of us play, not just children, but by playing out the feelings, he brings them to the surface, gets them out in the open, faces them, learns to control them, or abandons them. When he's achieved emotional relaxation, he begins to realize the power within himself to be an individual in his own right, to think for himself, to make his own decisions, to become more mature, and by doing so, to realize selfhood. So again, that's, again, from a therapeutic perspective. What I would pull out of there is that by taking the time to play, you can really face, you know, some of those emotional things and sometimes be more ready to do some of that work, to sit down and say, okay, you know, I think as a society, we save play for last, and I think that's a disservice.
Yeah, it's recess. It's a reward.
And you do it after. You know, if I get my work done, then I can draw for an hour.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah. And you know what's funny is one last observation for me is this piece that I just finished, and it's dropping tomorrow. I'm going to post it online. Actually, I got the pencils right here. This guy that started out is just a...
Jeez. Oh, man.
Oh, it just looks impressive because it's so big. It's not that. And actually, on the other side is the bad drawing I did where I was like, oh, you know, people say that He-Man should be really bulky, so I'm going to make the arms bulkier. And then it just wasn't coming off right. And
I can tell it's not a Jersey Drozd influenced anatomy.
Well, I also noticed that as I was doing this, that his pose is all wrong because it's an aggressive pose, and He-Man is not aggressive. He is defensive. And when I did this doodle in the spirit of play where I wasn't thinking about it, just like draw He-Man so that he feels right, then I landed the pose. This is where I was going with this, is this idea of retrospect. One of the things that's going to be in tomorrow's post is I decided to write up a full pitch for a He-Man miniseries. Not that DC's going to want to give me the gig because they don't want to do an all-ages He-Man comic, but maybe, who knows? He-Man would say, you can't win if you don't try, right? So I put together this whole pitch, and again, it was in this kind of playful kind of like, what would be like the five funnest things to happen in the He-Man universe if it were me? And don't think about story structure. Don't think about being clever. Just think of five awesome things. And I wrote them down. I just wrote down the awesome things that I would love to have happen. And as I worked out the ideas into like five little pitches, I realized that I had sort of decoded what makes He-Man work for me. And it's not the fantasy, it's not the science fiction, it's not the superpowers, it's the character-driven stories. Because when it felt right, and I was intuiting it in this playful kind of manner, and I just threw down the idea, I wasn't thinking about what makes a He-Man story work. But then upon reflection, I looked at it again the next day and said, what did I write down? I was like, you know, all these stories involve a character losing something and trying to get it back, or trying to be something more and not quite getting there and needing help or something like that. But it was always the tension was revolving around a character's reaction to something. And then as I went back and I looked through all the episode lists of the shows, like, yeah, most of these, that's exactly what they're doing. So again, it wasn't intentional. It was me just going like, what's awesome? I like awesome things. And what I came away with is a deeper understanding of a thing that I really, really love. So I don't know if that is at all contributing to the conversation, but
absolutely,
that is, and that's amazing. There's a, you just reminded me of something that I'm pretty sure it's not apocryphal, but it's how early id Software made games. They built stuff that they thought was cool, right? And so that's how Doom came about, right? That's how, yeah, Castle Wolfenstein came about. That's how Quake came about. That's you know, as they probably evolved their approach at that point, right? But, you know, became a more complex organization. But when they were, you know, mostly the Romero and Carmack and you know, a few others working together, they I just saw them quoted in a few different interviews, like, we thought this would be cool, so we made that thing. And so they were there. Yeah, I mean, in even in that act, right, such a different creative act, building a really complex piece of software to have a cacodemon throw a fireball at you, right? That's cool, and that's what they wanted to see. That's what they wanted to do—a big, you know, big robot spider with the brain that could also throw fireballs. But anyway, Robot Satan with a rocket launcher, also brilliant. Yeah. Anyway, that place is I don't know why we don't trust it that much. And when we do hear it, we a lot of times I've heard people react negatively to that, where they're like, oh, you know, that's so unprofessional or undisciplined, just because you thought it was awesome, really.
Yeah,
but
undisciplined. I love that word. Yeah, that's an especially good word to pull out for that counter argument, right? Because it implies that a rigid adherence to something is the adult thing to do. Right.
Yeah.
So going back to your original question before I hit the music, Rob, what you asked Kate was, how do you detect?
So there's a transition with like that work that you were recently building, that huge scene of the He-Man universe and whatnot, and went with some, you know, it was work, and then it became play again, and then it sort of had this energy, but then it almost became like, this was play, you discovered something, and now it's almost a new commitment or a choice or some kind of, I'm just wondering what you think about those strategies. Like, so you do follow your heart, you have something cool, and now it might have value or something tradable, right?
Absolutely.
What happens?
I'm smirking because there are thousands of books written on that premise alone. And I was looking on, we have a million books, and I was looking on the bookshelf and I was trying to pull a bunch of them, but just kind of almost even as a joke, because that's exactly what, I don't want to say the snake oil, but that everyone's trying to sell you, right? Do what you love, the money will follow. You know, all of those kinds of concepts, whistle while you work, and that sure. Book is all about, you literally track, like journal, what are the parts of your day, your work day that you love, and you journal those down, and then, you know, you do that for a few weeks, and then you take all of those things and you say, okay, if I just did those things, what would that profession be? You know, if I just did the things I love. And there's absolutely a truth to it. I love to watch like pop star documentaries, right? And they're filled with these stories. I just kept doing and doing what I loved and doing what I believed in, and I didn't listen to the naysayers, and, you know, as long as it was what I was loving to do, you know, then it was good. So you're not wrong. It's just like, I think that's the piece where it's the ideal state. It's what we all want, right? We all want to wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning and say, I can't wait to get downstairs to work on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then have it be something that you can engage in trade, or you can get paid for your time. Again, back to the timing we were talking about. You know, so I think you know, the pop psychology lesson there is you keep doing what you love, and you know, and it's very cliche.
But what about when it, I don't know, like, well, I'm curious about the, if you have like a strategy for the, and I don't know, maybe it's, I'm not asking a useful question, but it just seemed like the nature of that project, it became a project. It started out as play, became a project. And is it just being intentional about it, saying like, I'll find a strategy to have fun in producing this, but now I'm no longer committed to doing the expressive part of it as much, right? First it was play and I'm getting some things out of me, and all of a sudden now I'm reacting, and this thing is now it is work. It is a project. So I can choose to,
it changes it.
It does. Does it have to? Okay, it has. It does change it.
Well, I don't know if it has to. And you artists are a complex bunch. I'll say that right away. So many beautiful and wonderful stories and images are born out of play, right? But you get to that point where, Jersey, your second draft, you looked at it and you said, "Okay, this is great. This is getting exactly what I wanted out." And I'm guessing at that point, it then became, I can't wait to post this, or I can't wait to.
No, the first thing I did was I posted it on Instagram. Like, it was the moment I looked at it and said, hey, this is actually good. This is going to be a doodle, but this is good. That's when I snapped a picture, and, like, you know, it's what?
Yeah.
9 o'clock at night, I'm posting a picture on Instagram because I just can't wait for people to see it, right? So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great and beautiful thing. Like, nobody should ever feel bad about that. That is a great and beautiful thing.
Your lips to the internet's ears,
Kate. Everyone post more pictures. Share your work. But it's true. And I think there's a couple of different messages that I think of when coming through. So I think of, I struggle with my own personal creativity. And when I am doing something for play for me and it starts to look good, whether it's pottery or it's knitting or it's sewing, and I freeze, right? Now the anxiety sets in because this looks good. Now I got to finish it. And I think, Jersey, there is a linchpin in this whole discussion that you touched on at the beginning, and that is the way we deal with failure and that failure piece. And I don't know quite how to tie it in, and maybe you guys can connect the dots a little better, but there's that fear of failure that sets in, right? So I'm knitting and it's like, oh, this is turning out really cool, but if I screw it up, I'm done for. Or I'm throwing a pot, and if I, you know, I'm gonna try and trim this, I'm gonna screw it up, and then it's gone, it's done, it's to the wind. I think that the way we kind of honor failure in our work kind of creates some of that tension.
Well, you just hit on something that I wonder if. So the playground, this may be baloney, right? But I'm just curious if there's a connection. So as far as the playground situation, right? So there's sort of a closed system there where there's no final outcome, or it creates this safe zone for play, right? Play isn't like do something and then for sure, you know, now somehow engage in trade and share the thing or whatever.
You don't go onto the playground at recess and say, you may find at the 7 minute mark that you got something that you're going to have to capture.
Exactly. But then let's see. So in that closed system, it reminded me of, so what if your work had that safety zone too, where, the only thing that struck me is just being, and this is going to sound like some kind of, it reminded me of being, of finding a strategy to detach from the failure, right? So in a way, creating that safe zone is a way to say, I don't care if you stutter before you, you know, growl like a dragon, right? Doesn't matter. You're still being you're an effective playground dragon. No worries. In fact, I'm not even thinking on that. You know, I'm just going to say, haha, have at you, because I pretend I am having a sword. And I'm not even evaluating stuff. So I'm choosing not to evaluate. I'm creating a safe space. And it just reminds me of that. Choosing not to evaluate is a little bit like detaching from the risk. Because, you know, you could, it's getting attached to some kind of final result or commitment and reacting to it. Anyway, I'm just kind of picking themes and stuff that I'm hearing that that are in contrast with that when it's, because play is safe, and then the other stuff doesn't feel as safe. So how do you make it safe? And it's a little bit more 10,000 footy. Now I don't have then what I'm trying to reach for is a strategy.
Well, let me ask you guys this. This is one of the things I had jotted down in my notes as a stupid helpy tip, but I don't know if it's even, you know, I'd be curious what your reactions to it would be. Let me put it that way. You know, borrowing the recess idea. What if you gave yourself recesses and schedule them? Don't schedule them. You know, I've got re-addicted to the emergent task planner. And I put recesses in there. I put recesses in my day. There's a certain time where I shower. And there's a certain time where I take, you know, not necessarily a lunch break, but a reading break, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also set something. I'm sure there's some app you could get for like a smart device or for your desktop that like randomly will ping you at some time, right? Where you could say like, you know, randomly 3 times during this period. Maybe we could find it. I don't know. But ping me for, you know, from like 3 times today to remind me to take a recess.
I recommend checking out the app SuperBetter.
SuperBetter.
SuperBetter, which is a project of Jane McGonigal's, actually. Exactly, of course it is. That app, and actually it mentions others that will randomly send you a message where at some point in the future, you know, remind me that and it basically SuperBetter will it creates a game experience around goals you have related to your health, and they could be of any of, you know, related to mental health or physical health, could be related to yeah, I think the original drive to create it was about recovering from serious medical conditions, right? So anyway, but it's also been grown and evolved where there's missions and you can create your own and all that stuff that are along all sorts of different tracks, whether it's just, you know, I want to, honestly, if you're you know, working through things like just trying to have a little more fun in your day, up to depression, up to healing from a broken leg. I mean, that's anyway. And that app has some of that kind of remind you to.
So
take a break.
I want to get Kate's input on this. Like, what do you do with your daughter? Are there scheduled times for play, or is it something where you monitor her attitude, behavior, and say, you really need to break away and just do something with no intended purpose right now? how do you measure that, and how can we glean from that to measure ourselves to know when we should be instituting more playful activities?
I think I do less monitoring of that with Kaya than I do with Rob. He needs to be reminded to play more often than she needs to be reminded to play.
Yeah.
Very true.
And it's just the nature of her age and whatnot. But I as far as the stupid helpy tip of recess, I love it. And particularly people taking time out of their day to just truly be expressive in whatever creative way that is for them. And I struggle with that, and I like the idea of recess because, at least for our generation, that is something that brings up a positive emotion. It brings up the reminder of that release. of that time to free. Because I think when I want to sit down and journal or I want to sit down and write, I get very stressed out about that. If I were to say, I'm going to sit down and this is my recess time to just have some creative writing, that's a different emotional state for me.
Yeah.
So I like the recess idea because it does kind of conjure and bring back some of those emotions and that playfulness.
Yeah, yeah. When you sit down to write, right?
No.
I'm going to write today. Echo, 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 echo.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it just puts a ton of dread on you. And, you know, like for me, I mean, there's a difference between recess and vegging, right? Like I just got asked recently by somebody, like, how do you stay motivated on a project? Like, you have that initial burst of energy. How do you stay? How do you keep it going? Like, keep it going? I don't think you can, because it changes and it morphs and it evolves over the course of the project, depending on how long it is, you know. And I went back to some tired old advice, like take breaks, take walks, you know, monitor your time and look at it. But in retrospect, I think what I should have said was, is give yourself a recess every once in a while where, it's more of it's intentionally playful rather than passively playful, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say a recess to me wouldn't be, I'm going to go watch a half hour of TV,
right?
Or, you know, 3 hours of TV. Right. But if I say, you know, I need to relax or I need to take a break, that might be what what I need or what I do. Mm-hmm. So I really like the idea of recess just for what it conjures emotionally.
What if, so is there anything anyone should bring to recess, right? Can we actually stack a stupid helpy tip on top of this? Like, so is there any, like, so one of the benefits that recess has, at least, you know, when it was a scheduled part of our days, right? You had a playground, right?
Yeah.
So where's the playground? Like, wouldn't you have to say, like, I'm reminding myself to take recess and I brought the playground and boom, it's the whatever, a sketchbook. I mean,
oh man, I've got one.
What's it?
I'm one of those terrible men who doesn't read instruction manuals, who just like, I can intuit this. And then like an hour later, I'm behind the TV with like a cables around my neck and arms and I'm screaming and my wife has to do it. I like to figure out with my hands how something works or how to set something up. And that's proven to be disastrous at times. But when it comes to my tablet, that Galaxy Note that I got, I've used my recess time, and I've go on my Instagram feed. You can see all of my results from my recesses, where it's like, I want to learn this application. Well, am I going to go to YouTube and I'm going to watch a 20-minute video where some guy goes, this is the pen tool, this is the selection tool, this is a canvas? No, I want to get in there and I want to start messing with it. And so I use that time to go, well, let's figure out how this thing works. I download different art apps from the Android Google Play Store all the time. And then my goof around time is to try to draw something with this application that I don't know how to use. And because of that, again, this is where we get those like unintended side benefits. I'm learning layer paint really well. And some of the latest pieces that I've done on it, I think look pretty darn pro, considering that I'm doing them on this goofy little $500 tablet that's not meant for professional production. So, but you look at like the body of sketches, a lot of them are just like squiggling and doodling around. And another unintended benefit, I landed on a visual style that I never would have considered otherwise. I was working within the limitations of a certain kind of application that I didn't understand very well. And I landed on this kind of scribbly style that when I looked at it, I was like, that's appealing to me somehow, but I don't know why. When I do it in my sketchbook, I don't like it. But when I do it on this tablet, I like it for some reason. What's going on here? And Rob, you've seen some of these preliminary sketches I've been doing for a comic where I'm going to play around with a completely different style that I never would have tried before. How did I find it? Just by goofing around. How did I learn the programs? Just by goofing around. But I schedule time for that. I actually make the time to do that.
So you have not just recess scheduled, you've got a playground. You've got the, yeah. So the tablet's your playground. That's cool.
Well, the apps are my playground. The applications are the playground. It's learning, teaching myself new software in just by screwing around rather than It's like when I tried to learn Adobe Illustrator back in 1995, I remember I checked out from a place this like 8-volume set of VHS tapes. And it's like, hi, I'm Ted, and today I'm going to teach you about, you know? And I think I got about 6 minutes into it. I was like, "Boo, whatever. Oh, my God, this is terrible." And then so then the next day I went into work at the newspaper where I worked, and I was like, you know what? When I'm supposed to be taking breaks, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to play around with this Adobe Illustrator thing and figure out what's the big deal about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught myself how to draw on that. I'm not saying that you should always teach yourself how to draw, but I'm just saying that you can find yourself acquiring a greater amount of skill, which those industrial world types get really excited about, just by scheduling recesses where your playground is things you wish to learn. Because when you're trying to learn something in school, there are there's stakes. You get an A or you get a D. You get a pass, you get a fail.
Very true.
Yeah.
So some of that could be if you need, so it's not just having recess, it's not just having a playground, but also if you need some kind of outcome as incentive that, you know what, you might be learning something on top of all this. If you purposely, depending on your learning style though, right? So I would say if you don't need that incentive, that's cool too. Because you know what, find what's kind of fun is go into like GarageBand for iOS and then make a fart noise and sample it, right? And then you can play that on the piano, right? And all up and down the piano. You know, big chord of fart noise.
And I thought I had arrested development issues.
And that's a blast. And that's
that's awesome.
And there's no use for that. I'm not posting that.
True.
I'm not. Am I really? Well, maybe I will. But but I'm not. Anyway. So I wanted to add an alternate path there, not as a counter view or whatever, but like you, yes, I right. love that. I'm an immersive learner too. I love jumping in and getting caught under the wires or discovering stuff.
No, you're absolutely right. This goes back to a problem that I was highlighting in my classrooms where I was being explicit about the intended outcome, when the whole purpose of this discussion is to talk about the wonderful things that happen when you have no intended outcome. I don't want to dangle that carrot in front of anybody because.
But it's there too. It helps. That's helpful, but that's not the. You don't have to. You. That's not a.
That's not why I did it though. I mean, it's just I was doing it like, layer paint, $3. Let's see what this thing can do.
Jersey, the analogy that I would draw there is that you are exploring tools and figuring out how they work, just as children on the playground explore the new slide or the new monkey bars. Or what's this bouncy, twisty thing, right? I'm not going to be able to fully engage in my play until I know how this works.
Right. And
then while discovering it, like maybe it's supposed to be monkey bars, but I've figured out that, hey, this is actually, you know, a castle. And you know what I mean? So through that tool exploration, the play begins.
Yeah.
So I think it does kind of go, Rob, to your point of the playground matters, right? Or the playground counts.
Yeah.
We can't all just expect to say, it's recess time, now I'm playing. That's just not how we work as human beings. It'd be great if we could. Yeah. So kind of what you've demonstrated is you're exploring your playground. The drawings you've talked about, that's more your play.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's good. That's the analogy I would
cool.
put in.
Yeah.
What about... because recess has... restrictions. You are to stay within these grounds. You are not to run out into the parking lot. When I blow this whistle, you're going to line up on the wall and we're going to walk in single file. There are parameters. What do you guys think about creating artificial or arbitrary restrictions on your recess, at least to start out with, to see about, and like, for instance, like, I only get to use this tool. I'm going to use only ballpoint pen to limit myself so that I'm not crippled by, right? So you don't take the kids out of the playground and say, you get to do whatever you want. no holds
totally
barred.
But the kids will add arbitrary, yeah, again, go back to what's a game, it's voluntary obstacles and whatnot. So you may, if you want to be playful in a game, in a gameful way, you might say, guess what, all the rocks, hot lava, you have to go from equipment to equipment without touching those rocks because you're gonna die.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's very playful, honestly.
People should know there is a lot of hot lava in our house.
We have hot lava, and it changes.
Yes. It's a big deal.
A lot. I step in hot lava constantly.
One of the things I wrote into that He-Man pitch was a scene where a character is dangling over a pit of hot lava, and I caught myself and said, is that a little trite, you know, hot lava, really? And then I went, slap, 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 slap. What are you talking about? This is a kid's book. Kids love hot lava.
Yes, exactly. And please consider hot lava for a few more seconds and then keep it there, you know? Like,
yeah, I kept
it. It's freaking awesome.
When I looked at it the next day, I was like, that's really good. You know, it's yes, not Tolstoy, but it's for what I want. It's perfect. What about limitations that take you out of your comfort zone? I mean, does that kind of spoil the broth because now you're turning it into exercise or something?
Again, if it's voluntary, right? I mean, you're choosing that obstacle. So if you want to, you're being more adventurous with that kind of, that's what I'm hearing.
And I would go back to kind of the definition of play or the purpose of play. The purpose of play is for expression, right? And sometimes it's to process things. So if I know, personal example, I know I have a hang up. I can't draw. I have to say that on every episode that you guys invite me into. I think having some of those things that take you outside your comfort zone, play is a safe place, right? So I'm going to go outside my comfort zone, but it's going to be safe because failure's okay. I'm going to sit and draw, and it doesn't matter if everything looks like stick people because I'm doing it for me. I'm doing it for fun. So I think putting some parameters to take you outside your comfort zone is absolutely something I would build in.
And I think as some kind of threshold to watch out for is the stress factor of it, right? Because it doesn't have to, you're reminding me of something that I habitually do that I'm working on, which is, considering it, maybe I talk myself into the, you know, the recess or whatever, but then I'll think, okay, cool, you know what, hey, guess what, there's no actual work product, there's no artifact here, I don't have to finish a drawing or a song or a certain feature in the code, I'm just playing, no worries. But then there's another subtle, more invisible artifact, which I think is exercise or fitness, right? Where all of a sudden you set some kind of goal that doesn't, that may not be play. That's a gray area, right? And so that can be fun, but it also could be stressful, which again, like I don't know if that's like if that's out of bounds, right? If that's jumping into hot lava, if you're like, wait a minute, this is frustrating. That's not recess anymore. What have you, but that's something I consider because I'll make it an exercise and kind of mess up my recess.
And I think one thing to add to the conversation is everybody needs to keep in mind that you're going to have days that you do that. You're going to have days that you mess up your recess. You're going to have days that you start out with, this is going to be the coolest thing I've ever done and I can't wait to post it. You know what I mean? It's about practice. And I think that's also important to kind of point out. I think the main keys is, you know, allow the play to be an expression of what you're feeling, what you're thinking. Make it a safe place for yourself. And just know that it's practice. It's, you know, we're adults with responsibilities and habits and everything else. So it's not going to be perfect every time. Don't beat yourself up over that. Keep moving. Keep doing it.
Well, and I loved that story you told at the very top of the episode where you sat down on the floor. You knew when you were feeling not comfortable with the situation. It was time to stop and look at the situation. And that's just what happened with that drawing I was showing a moment ago where I was drawing it. It was kind of looking like a thing. And then I got about, you know, 3/4 of the way through the sketch. I was like, this doesn't look right. And I don't know why. Time to sit on the floor and look at it. And, oh, wait, I just sucked the fun out of it because I was thinking about what other people suggested rather than just doing it for my own purposes. I love that idea of being able to listen, monitor your own emotions and know when it's time to stop and look at them again. Because if the whole idea is expressing yourself and expressing your emotions, then shouldn't we listen to them as well? God, did I say words? I don't even know.
I think you did. And I think that that's I think we nailed it on the ground. What do you guys think?
Yeah. I think
So what I'm thinking.
Whoa! Sorry, I just accidentally hit stop. Don't play it.
You fell in hot lava.
I did fall in hot lava. I was trying to hit some segue music and I wound up hitting the closing music. We're not done yet.
Shut that door. No, keep the door open. Keep the door open, because I was thinking we should let's transition to talking about Quest for a little bit.
Yes, let's. Okay. So,
Jersey.
You got some announcements to make re-quest number 8.
Yeah, so full deck of cards is... That's the quest in progress. We announced it last episode, and in a nutshell, it's a series of mini quests that are all facilitated through a simple like a piece of paper, a card, right? So you would work on it digitally, or you print it out, and then there's a little challenge on there, kind of like something you would come run into in a magazine, a little fun exercise, right? Little puzzle to solve, and it's meant to go quick. And you get points for depending on how quick you solve it. That's definitely part of it. And so part of the deal is there's like 11 cards. And that's what I wanted to visit here is to touch on it, remind people that it exists. You can go to leanintoart.com/quests and, visit Quest 8 here. It'll be right there when you arrive at that URL. And I will, after this episode, now unlock more cards. And I was planning on, last episode, I kind of changed the rules a little bit, right? So first I said, hey, once people finish 3 of these cards, I'm unlocking 1 card and do 1 at a time. Then the game designer in me thought, that sucks, dude. You need to make it more, have more decision, more possibilities unlocked. So people aren't just linearly chipping away at some, painful thing, right? Or even if it's fun, like why just make it, expose it so slowly? Okay, so I'm like, we're going to unlock 3 more cards. Once someone finishes these 3, I don't care if it's 1 person or 3 different people, doesn't matter, unless it's Jersey or I, which we don't count in this one. That's it, right?
Ooh.
It's been a few days and oops, so I should have unlocked a few cards, mea culpa. I'm unlocking 6 cards now.
Whoa!
After this episode, 6 cards are getting unlocked, and that'll bring us up to 9. There'll be 2 more left to unlock. Same deal. As soon as all 9, someone has posted an example and on Twitter using the hash code LeahQuest8, I will unlock the last 2. So with once I see up through 9. Have happened. So
and Ashley Control Alt Lee was like on this quest like the day of.
Yeah. That was fun.
What are you looking at?
And then there's a person, John, a fellow, I believe, John Blow.
Oh yeah.
French spelling there. And that's the person that unlocked that kind of crossed the threshold, and it was the duck who needed a career. That was the card.
That's the one I was telling you about before we started recording. He's a local guy. He's from Ann Arbor or the Ann Arbor area.
Oh, funny. Sweet. So, yeah, okay.
He and his son were showing me, his son was working on the quest too. So that's awesome.
That's awesome. All right, cool. So yeah, thanks for doing that. And, totally achievement unlocked. More quest cards coming your way.
Sweet. So what's the deadline on this one? We got two more weeks.
A day before, yeah, so essentially almost two more weeks. So I think it's the 28th.
Right.
So we'll talk about all these things in more detail on the episode we record on the 29th.
August 29th, 2013 at 9 p.m. Mm-hmm. Eastern Time, streamed live at comicsaregreat.tv. So, mm-hmm. Cool. Cool. Well, now that the next batch are unlocked, now I can get involved.
And, sweet. And I don't know if you saw, we had an interesting tweet, too. There was a Jeff Dreher that mentioned, is a friend of mine, but he was like, hey, you guys need to do some kind of Kickstarter with this. And I was like, what? But that's intriguing.
A Kickstarter.
So I'm like... The quest cards. Just excited about the quest cards. And I have no idea.
That is intriguing.
Make them into a little notebook.
I don't know. Quest notebook. Recess
quest book? Deck. I mean, like, yeah. Oh gosh, what was that thing that Brian Eno did?
The Oblique Strategies.
Yes. Right?
Yeah. Oh, this is totally a related concept.
If you had them printed on some kind of dry erase material. Mm-hmm. Right? So they're reusable.
Totally.
And then you have a digital version that people can just reuse. Like, here's the PDF version, and then here's the card. Oh, there's something to that idea.
I don't know.
I've been looking for something to like, actually try out a Kickstarter on. That's an interesting one.
Fair enough. All right.
Data strategy, well, deck of cards.
Kinda worth cool. considering. So, yeah, anyway, this has been a fun one. And this is all about, we want to make the quest as much of a fun warm up, be playful. And then it's really fitting with the whole theme of this episode. And, because the other quests are, I love them all, honestly. It's just that they are more of a boss battle, and I don't always have time for a boss battle to warm ups for the day. But anyway,
yeah,
it's an experiment. It's been going well. So, yeah, thank you, John Blow and Control-Alt-Lee. Looking forward to what people do next.
And, Kate, thank you. As far as I'm concerned, if you want to be a permanent third host of the show, that would be fine by me.
Thank you, guys. It's a lot of fun to be here. I appreciate you guys letting me sit in and share kind of a different perspective. So it's fun. Thanks.
That's cool. Yeah, we hear good stuff when you're on the show. So
yeah, actually, yeah. and where can we find you if people wanted to give you any kudos or accolades? Even though you were here in the spirit of play, it's always nice to be told that you did a good job.
You can find me at Babies Love Comics and Baby Comics on the Twitter.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Anything else that we need to make any noise about before we head home?
No, can't wait to see what's...
I got one. Hey, if you guys liked this episode, if you thought this was interesting or intellectually stimulating or just kind of fun, a great way you could let us know is to go to iTunes and give us a star review. You don't even have to write a review. You just give however many stars you think we deserve. I think this was a 4.5-5-star episode. It was pretty good. But you make that decision for yourself, or you can go to the YouTube video where you're watching this and you can give us a thumbs up. That's a great way to help more people discover this stuff. You can't be the only person out there who enjoys this. I bet there's other people out there who are wondering where a show like this is. You can help them find it by boosting our rankings in those different arenas, both on YouTube and iTunes. So, and thanks to the folks who have been writing reviews on iTunes. Very, very kind things said there, and we really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
So there, now we're done. So until next time, 2 weeks from now, thanks again, Kate. I have been Jersey Drozd of leanintoart.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I have been Rob Stenzinger. I'm at leanintoart.com, and I'm Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.